Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your outpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is always, the ready for Thanksgiving, Drea Kaufman.
I don't know, you just really put me up there as to being ready. I mean, I guess, in fairness, I bought everything this year.
That's good.
We're not having a big Thanksgiving. I don't want to make Thanksgiving for three people, so I purchased everything from Whole Foods. So I guess maybe I am ready. Quick on that one. Well done. You know me better than I know me.
See, that's what I'm saying. Well, yeah, we're about to celebrate Thanksgiving here in the States as we're recording this episode. And gosh, we're at, chapter 22. Chapter 23. Excuse me. That's how wrong I am. I cannot believe. So, wow. And we're at Malfoy Manor. Before we get there and dive into the chapter, of course, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're, of course, on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Music and Spotify and all of those places. If you're on Apple Podcasts, give us a star rating review. Let people know what you think of the show. And then you can find us all over the place online. We're at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. You can send us an email over at thenerdparty.com/contact. And you can find us on Instagram at the Nerd Party. So many places to find us, Drea, but I think this chapter starts with a bang, legitimately, because Hermione hits Harry in the face with a spell so that it messes up his face so that he won't be so easily identifiable as Harry Potter with that scar on his head.
Yeah, and then from there, they all kind of start to try and convince these Snatchers that there's somebody other than who they are. But interestingly, I find this is a part missing very much so from the movie that I feel like they totally could have done. Is all throughout these books, we are made to feel completely terrified of Fenrir Greyback. And Harry recognizes his voice right here at the beginning as he's talking to Hermione, which adds a whole level of, I think they're already kind of in deep water or in hot water. And now it even makes it more hot water. Like, I'm terrified for them and I know what's going to happen. So,
yeah, you know, it's also awful when they realize that the Snatchers there are not just any Snatchers. These happen to be Snatchers who are running with Fenrir Greyback. And so this is a extremely dangerous situation that they find themselves in. And they all lie about who they are. Harry says that he's Vernon Dudley. Ron lies about,
he says he's Stan Shunpike. And then they're like, no, we know Stan. You're not Stan. And then he says he is. What does he say he is then?
Barty Weedley. So,
because they smacked him in the face, yeah. And now he can't talk correctly.
And then, of course, Hermione lies and says that she's Penelope Clearwater. It is interesting, too, because, like you said, they smacked Ron in the face so badly, he can't really talk right because they've probably broken his nose. They ask, they tease them about, tripping the taboo. And Ron's like, it was just an accident. It was just an accident. And of course, we hear the rationale for them tabooing in the first place. You know, the fact that it's the Order of the Phoenix who likes to use Voldemort's name. And that's how they've actually caught a few people. And in their group of people that they have taken with them, we find out Dean is still alive. Dean Thomas, which is great. They also have Griphook with them as well. So that group that we heard earlier in a few chapters back that was traveling the country, the goblins and like Dean Thomas, some of them made it out alive. So it's kind of nice to know that the Dean has not been put on the expired list just yet.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to kind of get confirmation that, he's okay. I like that in here when it could be the darkest of dark, she still gives you a little bit of hope, right? Griphook and Dean made it through. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of joy to be had there, even though they're kind of in dire circumstances, but it also gives them some allies, right?
Right.
And I think that that's important to Harry, and that's sort of like a little bit of what keeps them going.
Well, and it's really interesting, too, because, you know, they don't have a Vernon Dudley on their list. And, you know, Harry kind of makes up the story about how his, you know, father works at the ministry. One of the guys kind of like asks him, of course, you know, what house are you in? And he says Slytherin. And then they make fun of him since, you know, they're like, oh, that's what they think that we want to hear, you know. And then they're like, but they don't know where the common room is. And of course, Harry knows exactly where the common room is. And he tells them because he's been mm-hmm. there. So his story is kind of lining up in the sense that somebody else is then like, oh, yeah, I think I know his Dudley in that department at the ministry. And so they're talking about taking them to the ministry. But then things begin to fall apart because they keep finding things in the tent that start to give them away. Like they find the sword and they find some glasses and they realize that they've actually got Harry Potter, or they think they've got Harry Potter. And not only that, but Harry is also at this exact moment now having to fight off visions of what's happening with Voldemort, which the worst possible timing, Voldemort, the worst possible timing.
Yeah. And I think the real kind of nail in their coffin is actually a newspaper that they had.
Yes.
Someone's looking at the Daily Prophet and it's got Hermione on the cover.
Yep.
And they're like, this looks an awful lot like that girl. She said to be traveling with Harry. We found these glasses. All these pieces kind of come together and they're just like, I just see them like hanging their heads and being like, F.
Like, yeah.
Crap. And, you know, they don't really fight it. They kind of go. And it's interesting because they have a whole conversation about whether or not they go to the ministry or what do they do. And she makes an interesting call out here about something actually about Greyback that Harry catches. And that even though he's sort of this very trusted and savage Death Eater, he's actually not kind of in this inner circle. He still is sort of shunned for being a werewolf, much like we've kind of alluded at Lupin having to deal with in the real world. Even that prejudice continues on into this like horrible group of people because he was not branded with the dark mark.
Yeah, I one of the things I was just, you pulled that out and I'm a little tongue-tied, but I thought that was really interesting too. Because it yeah. shows you that there is a hierarchy in this side, obviously. There, you know, and Fenrir is never going to be able to make it to the upper echelons.
I love that word. Yeah. I love
yeah.
that word. I don't get to use it enough, but
yeah.
I love that word.
It's a fun word. So, but what I love is how subtle it is that Rowling reminds you that the Death Eaters are such a speciest, you could say, as well as, you know, racist side. It's all the isms, really. That's kind of they embody all of the isms, really, that are just so bad. But this idea that because of something that obviously he cannot control. He had no control of the fact that he became a werewolf. Even though he's joined their side, he will still never be able to be one of the top level guys. He can't even get right. the dark mark on him because his blood basically is too foul. And it's such a small little thing, but it's a moment because Harry realizes that, you know, he can't call Voldemort. And this is a reminder of just how bad this side really is. That somebody as bad as Fenrir Greyback will never be bad enough, basically, for them in that way. Like because of things he could never control.
Right. Someone who is this sort of loyal and follows blindly still can't join the ranks officially, if you will, because of something that's completely out of his control. And I feel like that is just the perfect perfect depiction of all of those isms you're talking about, right? It's totally out of their control. It doesn't even matter. He's literally doing the Dark Lord's bidding to the fullest extent, right? And enjoying it. Let's be honest here. Not that I'm giving any praise to Fenrir Greyback here, but you know, I think it's important to note the true, I guess, core of that pure-blooded message that they're conveying. Like, they are living and breathing it as much as they possibly can. And that makes it that much more terrifying, right? Like, it's that much more, I don't know the word I'm looking for. It's that much more, like, Nazi-ish, right? It's that much more cultish that they are living and breathing it, even though people are doing their bidding. And I think that's just terrifying. And you have to stop and ask yourself, like, it's good. I guess it's good that Fenrir is getting something out of this, because honestly, he shouldn't be getting. I mean, he's not getting anything else out of this, and he's never going to change. So you got to ask yourself, what's he getting out of this deal? And it's, you know, small innocent children, but we don't have to go into that. But yeah, it's such a small aside, and she kind of calls it out. But I also love that they're not even trusting the ministry either. And there's this power struggle throughout the whole chapter as who's going to get into his favor, who's going to take the accolades for this capture, who's going to get the glory, right? And I think that is so true in so many groups. People are not worried about who's doing the right thing or what's the right thing to do or how do we do it. It's how do I do it for myself? And I think that's just, it plays out in this section. It plays out in the next chapter. It's why they don't go to the ministry. It's why they decide to go to the Malfoy Manor in the first place, the name of the chapter. But yeah, they ultimately decide to go, and Harry holds on tight. Well, actually, he tries to not hold on tight. He tries to hold on to Ron and Hermione and tries not to hold on to Fenrir Greyback. But they just sort of brace themselves for what's about to happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is really interesting that they choose to go to the Malfoys, because they're like, well, the ministry, that's not where the headquarters is, basically. What I think it's really interesting is it gives you a realization that the ministry means nothing to Voldemort. You know, it's under his control, but he doesn't care. He hasn't made his base there. His base is now, he's taken over at Malfoy Manor. And I love...
Which supports, when we talked about in previous chapters, it supports the idea that he can't make his base the ministry, right? Because he needs there to be some sort of distance enough that there's, you know, not there, that there's sort of this plausible deniability of him actually playing puppet master in the ministry, right? So he couldn't really make his home base there. I think we talked about that a couple chapters ago. So I think it just continues to play into that, like, strategic coup that he has overthrown, mm-hmm. that he's decided to hold up his headquarters elsewhere.
Well, and it's interesting too, because one, Harry knows Voldemort's not there, so it's good for them in some ways. But he does begin to see some things, and he is going up to, Voldemort's going to this castle, and he goes into this tiny little window. He fits himself into this tiny little window, and he comes on this very old person, and the person tells him, you know, you've come, and I thought you would, but your journey is pointless. I never had it. So you could tell that, when we know that Harry's right, you know, he's searching for the wand. He's searching for this hallow. And as that's happening, which is kind of happening through this whole time, you know, they get to the Malfoys, and I think this is so interesting. We get a sense of how much the Malfoys have fallen in repute among the other Death Eaters, because Lucius is so excited at the fact that this could be Harry Potter, and he's like, this could, everything could be forgiven if this is the case. And so he makes Draco come over, and this is fascinating, because what we get here is Draco saying, to every question he gets about, is this Harry Potter? Is this Ron Weasley? Is this Hermione Granger? I don't know.
Yeah, and I want to take a quick step back because there's this idea that everything will be forgiven, but I don't know that we truly appreciate or understand everything that needs to be forgiven, right? Like, we have some allusions to things, but I think that this is kind of the moment we really realize the Malfoys themselves have sort of fallen from the upper echelon, as you said. And, you know, you kind of get the indication that because of their pure blood status, they're kind of allowed to remain just based on their pure blood in relation to Bellatrix, right? But, you know, that they have also kind of fallen from grace. They look shabby. I think they're described, Draco looks like super distraught. Yeah, and then we kind of get this where Draco's just sort of very noncommittal, refuses to identify them, refuses to like say yes or no, and we don't really know why.
I think what's fascinating is to see the way that this is maybe signaling a change in this character. And I think what's kind of fascinating in it is when you think about it, it does a little bit feel like a possible shift that we saw at the beginning of the book. Remember, Dudley had a shift when it came to Harry. And here, the fact that his parents, especially his dad, wants to call Voldemort here, the fact that he's willing to lie, even though he knows Voldemort might be coming. And he's even reminded of, you know, we cannot make the same mistakes that Raoul and Dolov did, you know, because we know what would happen. And so he gets the picture of the prophet, and he's pretty sure that this is them. And so he's about to call Voldemort. And then, of course, who walks in but Bellatrix? And she just takes over the whole scene. And things kind of get worse the moment that she walks in the room.
Yeah. And to your point about Draco, I think at this point, it's kind of unclear as to whether Draco is doing this because he is having a change, at least to me. I'm having a hard time not reading into it as a change of heart and more just seeing that it definitely is a shift from the sort of very arrogant, know-it-all, braggy kid we meet at the very first part of the very first book. But, you know, it's hard to tell if it's literally just him shrinking into himself and he's just afraid to say one way or the other because he also knows, you know, if he's right, it's this glorious day. But if he's wrong, like, again, he just threatened, you know, his dad just pointed out what happened to others who were wrong. So, you know, for me, I don't know that I could say one way or the other if this was like him having a change of heart, towards the trio and towards everything, or if it's genuinely just him having a change in personality and too afraid to weigh in one way or the other. And I think as we continue to read through the rest of this book and the rest of the series, I can be a little more conclusive. But right now, I just know that he's sort of being like cowardly about everything.
Well, yeah. And I think that's the great thing is like you just can't tell at this moment. You know, we right. know. But I mean, we can't tell at this moment exactly
Matt and I know.
Where he know. Is. And so it's what makes it so odd, though, because, you know, before this, we've always seen Draco be quite
he's very much so a know-it-all.
And verbose.
He's like he's like the opposite of Hermione, who has this very factual know-it-allism. He's got this very arrogant mm-hmm. know-it-allism, right? He knows everyone. He's in everything. But yeah, this is like the moment where he doesn't want you to look at him. He doesn't want you to acknowledge that he exists. Like, leave me alone. It's very interesting for sure. And then his aunt Bellatrix walks in, and like you said, she sort of commands the room from here as sort of, I like to think of her as the highest ranking Death Eater, mm-hmm. right? And she comes in and really starts to put the screws to everyone. And at first, I think she's open to the idea of calling the Dark Lord until she sees something that one of the Snatchers has, and it sets her off.
Yeah, I mean, what it is that she sees the sword. And, of course, she is very worried because the sword is supposed to be in her vault. And so she asks them, you know, of course, where they got the sword, and they tell her that they don't know. So she talks about, she's trying to get across to the rest of the Malfoys just how much trouble, how bad this is. And so they take the prisoners, they take Ron and Harry down to the dungeon, not the dungeon, but the basement of the house.
The cellar.
Yeah, it's like the cellar.
Yeah.
The cellar basement.
Which
yeah.
should only yeah. be reserved for wine,
yeah,
to
exactly.
be fair. Or whiskeys.
Yes. Yes.
People do not belong there.
And she keeps Hermione because she's going to torture her. But then she also asks for a grip hook to be brought to her so she can tell, she get told whether or not the sword is legit or not. And so the boys get thrown into prison, the cellar. And it turns out that Luna is down there, as is Mr. Ollivander. And I love that, of course, Ron has the deluminator so he can create light in the room, and they're able to let them go. And before they, before Griphook is taken out, Harry asks him, he's like, please, you have to lie. You have to lie that this is not the real sword. And so Hermione's being tortured, and it's, I mean, the screams are awful that we're hearing. And Griphook tells tells Bellatrix that it is fake, and she immediately has a sigh of relief.
Yeah, which is so weird, because at this point, we have no idea what's happening or, like, why she's flying off the handle, right? All we know is that she thinks they've been in her vault at Gringotts, and that this is where the real sword was, because Snape was supposed to put it in there for her. So there's, like, so much to unpack there. There's so much there. There's just so much going on, and Bellatrix is such an unreasonable person, and they're really catching this sort of like secondhand as well, right? Because they are hearing it through the cellar door and they're not there to see it. But yeah, it's pretty epic what's happening.
Yeah. And
the goblin, it's surprising too from what we know of the goblins, and especially Griphook, who we kind of know has no love for the wizarding community, as we've kind of overheard in his conversations in a couple chapters. I don't know if it was a couple chapters ago or the last book. But yeah, you know, he's got no real reason to lie. So it's also interesting that he opted to do that.
In all of this craziness, because all of this stuff kind of happens very quickly, but he has... Mm-hmm. He looks through the pouch that he had been given, that he has like the snitch in and everything, and he pulls out the mirror and he sees this eye that looks like Dumbledore's, and he calls for help. And so as Griphook has told Bellatrix that it's not the real sword, all of a sudden there's a crack in the cellar and Dobby appears, which is... like the best thing ever. And I just love Harry's like,
and they're so confused.
Yeah, they're like, you can get in here? Wait, can you get people out of here with you?
Wait, how did you know we were here? What's going on?
It's such a great moment. And it's a moment that you needed here, because everything was looking awful. And what's hard about it is that at the same time, Harry's still having visions and he's trying to fight the visions. And we see like Voldemort being told that, you know, that this person welcomes death, that, you know, and my death isn't going to give you what you want, and there's so much you don't understand, and that person is dead. And so after all of this,
so he kills him, and I love that the first thought that Harry sort of reads through Voldemort is like almost this parental response that I mean, honestly, it kind of made me chuckle a little bit. It was like, if they call me back and this is not a big deal, I'm going to be so angry right now. Like, he has this, like, I always think of it. It totally reminds me of, like, a parent's response. Like, what you do with, oh my gosh, if you came in my room and you woke me up and you are not dying, you will wish you were dying, right? Only, I mean, he's serious about his. I'm not serious about mine as a parent, but it has like that very reactionary thought as he starts to sort of whoosh back. And actually something happens here that I'm actually did not realize, which is that he couldn't apparate back because he was too far away.
Yeah. Like, so he's doing this weird flying thing that we kind of saw at the beginning of the book. So
yeah. And I didn't realize there was like a distance thing on apparating. I thought you just had to know where you were going. So for me, this was like, huh, so you have to know where you're going and be within a certain reasonable distance of said destination. Mm-hmm. Well, that ruins my ability to like apparate myself to Australia or something.
Well, and this is really interesting because they hear upstairs this loud noise in the cellar and they tell Wormtail to go check it out. And as he's on his way down, Harry, you know, it tells Ron, we're going to have to tackle him. We're going to have to try and get his wand so we can get out of here. And as they're fighting Wormtail, as he comes in, he starts choking Harry, you know, in this fight. And Harry's like, you owe me, Wormtail. And then the strangest thing happens, which is that silver hand that he was given by Voldemort chokes him to death.
Yeah, it's so interesting because we don't see it coming. Like, it's not even like he agreed to help. It's not, it's literally like he had a moment where he thought and he was like, maybe I'll have some pity. And the instrument that the Dark Lord gave him turned on him. And that's so, so different. I mean, I don't think in the book do we see him die in the movies? I think he just stops showing up in the movies.
You know, it's been a while since I've seen the movie.
I think he's on the ground after they apparate away, which we'll get to in like half a second, so I'm not ruining anything. But anyway, it's just not the same as what happens in the movie. It's very almost traumatic, especially for Ron and Harry to just kind of like watch this happen and not be able to do anything about it. They try to help him, but... Yeah, it's an interesting sort of like, I don't know, fail safe that Voldemort has put into this hand.
Well, and so I kind of read it as that this is a, and I don't know if this is the case, but you know, we know that certain acts can have a big magical consequence, obviously, like Harry's mother's sacrifice. And so I'm wondering, you know, in many ways, the act of saving Wormtail, I wonder if that is part of the reason that this hand is doing what it's doing. That it has something to do with, you know, the fact that the hand has been given to him by Voldemort, but also, actually, I know exactly what it is, and I can't say. I just came to it.
Oh.
Yeah, it has to do with something at the end of the book, which we'll get to in a second.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah. But no, just put a pin in. Know that we know what we're talking about. I think I just figured it out.
Yeah, at this stage, I always took it as Voldemort knew that Wormtail would eventually betray him because we know he's a known coward. He's a known guy who takes the easiest way out. He hid as a rat for what, however long that was. I don't remember now, 10 years or 15 years or whatever. And you know, I always took it as Voldemort knew he wouldn't be true for and loyal. And so he sort of built it in as like the second he's not loyal anymore, that's his like fail safe, right? To protect himself. It's sort of like Voldemort's version of payback, right? Like, I'm going to give you this, but when you betray me, it's going to turn and kill you because, you know, my kindness is only extended to those who are loyal to me. That's how I always sort of read the hand turning on him.
Yeah, yeah. But, I think that's a good way looking at it.
Yeah, but I mean, regardless, it strangles him to death in the cellar. It's terrifying. And, you know, at this point, I think this is when Harry like fully snaps over to Voldemort. This is when they start to call him with the dark mark. This is when we see him kill the guy in the cell, who we don't know who it is yet, but we know who it is. I just think it's so interesting that, you know, then all of a sudden Harry sort of snapped back to his current body and consciousness when, you know, Ron sort of bursts into the drawing room to confront Bellatrix.
Yeah, and this is great. I mean, they're, you know, they're able to kind of stun them, grab wands. I mean, Harry is able to actually wrestle three wands from Draco. And then he's able to, stun Greyback. And
he stuns Greyback. Thrice the spells.
and then you get Dobby also showing up and saying, like, you know, you shall not harm Harry Potter.
And he drops the chandelier
on
him.
Which is so great. I mean, it's the movie does actually a pretty good job on this part. It really does. It's beautiful because once he drops the chandelier, they're able to escape with him. And as they're disapparating with Dobby, you get Narcissa throwing a knife. And they land at what we all hope is going to be Shell Cottage, Bill and Fleur's house. And we have Harry looking around to make sure everybody is okay. And Dobby is dying. And his last words are, you know, Harry Potter. And it's just heartbreaking. Like, I was reading this today and I was just, you know, it's such a beautifully done scene. And, you know, this character that has meant so much to Harry in such strange ways, you know... all from, you know, making his bones disappear having bludgers come after him or, you know, not having his mail delivered all summer. And all. This is such a strange relationship. And yet one, I think that Harry's always been kind of proud of, especially since he was instrumental in freeing him. And then to have him, you know, come to rescue him and stand up for Harry the way that Harry had stand up for him. Like, you know, that he's a free elf. He gets to make these choices and his choice is to fight for his friends. And it's just it's a very emotional scene. And in all honesty, as the chapter ends here, it is the catalyst to which thrusts the rest of the story into full motion. Like, we will not stop in the sense that everything that's going to happen now is driving towards the end. This is the point in which the story just like snaps its fingers and never lets up.
Yeah. So first of all, it's Bellatrix who throws the knife, not Narcissa.
Oh, did I say Narcissa?
I just want to clarify just because.
My bad.
You know, like, yes, because of things that will come in coming chapters, right? Bellatrix is the super evil one who kills Dobby, because that matters, right? I think that Dobby sort of sacrificing himself for Harry is because he knows that Harry is important, right? Like, he knows there's things bigger than himself, and he decides that he's gonna go for it. And I think it's a truly beautiful and selfless moment. And I think the reason we love Dobby so much is because he represents that, at least for me, he represents that weirdo, that sort of awkward, I'm doing the right thing, but I'm not always doing the right thing, right? I always have good intentions, but sometimes they involve dropping a cake on someone's aunt or, you know, doing other things like that are going to get someone in trouble, but honestly is for their good. He represents that in all of us, who is awkward and shaky, but honestly is so pure-hearted. And I love that she uses the house elf, because that is one of those characters, right? We talk a lot about the isms and things like that. We talked a lot about the sculpture in the ministry of, you know, wizards stepping down on all other beings. And I think the fact that Harry has been able to garner the trust and loyalty of one of those other magical beings that would normally either be a servant or a drunk, as we know with Winky, right? That it's so beautiful, and it truly represents the purity and the sort of like the parallel, the yin and the yang of the Death Eaters, who won't even make their most loyal subject a Death Eater, and Dobby, who is a free elf who chooses to sacrifice himself for the greater good. Like, it just really shows that parallel from beginning to end of this chapter, that it's just so impactful. And I think we're all impacted when you take a very innocent character who doesn't really deserve to get stabbed in the chest with a knife, and you stab him in the chest with a knife, right? Like, that causes you as a reader to feel much more than if it was a more flawed character, if you will, right? Joss Whedon is known for doing that, for killing the most innocent of his characters, because it causes you the most emotional distress. And so I feel like she takes a little bit of the page out of that book too. And as we're going to come to see, not to spoil anything, but it's going to work, right? Like, it's going to work on Harry.
Well, and I think it makes sense. You know, I think what the beauty of it is that what we see here is that the love that Dobby has for Harry and his friends is one of true love. It's self-sacrificial love, right? It's the same love that Harry has been portraying over and over for people for years, right? And it's the same thing that allowed Dobby to be free in the first place, right? It's just, I think what's beautiful is to see then him reciprocate that back towards Harry. You know, and it's a beautiful thing to use his freedom for the benefit of others, not just for his own benefit. And I think that's a real testament to the storytelling. And I think it's a beautiful statement of what it means to truly love one another, you know. And that's the core of this story, really. I mean, Harry Potter is not just a story about death. In many ways, I think it is about true love in all of its forms.
And I think even to that extent, expanding upon that, because I absolutely agree, as I think the other element to a lot of the story is this idea that to be a functional society, there has to be a certain level of altruism in each person contributing to the society, right? Like, you have to do something beyond yourself, and beyond like what you get an immediate tangible payback for, right? You have there has to be action beyond the intrinsic value that's exchanged for what you do, right? I know we talked about it a couple episodes ago, like wearing a mask is an easy way to be altruistic in the current US society, and I think globally as well. And it's so interesting, because I think that this book and the current society both show how hard that ask can be when you're actually asking it, right? So for me, it's about love, and then also that element of love as almost an altruism, that you have to love society beyond yourself as well in order for us to sort of all function together in this crazy thing we call the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting. You know, the next chapter is going to be huge. We're going to learn a lot of things in the next chapter, and I'm really excited to get there. You know, before we do, Drea, where can everybody find you if they want to catch up with you and just see how things are going? Maybe, you know, what that Thanksgiving meal actually looks like.
Yeah, if you want to see how my Whole Foods Thanksgiving turns out, and this is not a plug for Amazon or Whole Foods, it just happens to be the closest place I can pre-order a small amount of Thanksgiving food. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me pretty much on most of the social media platforms under the name Matt Rushing 02. And you can also follow me and the TFM podcast I do on Twitter called the 602 Club. It's Just That on Twitter as well. And it's a general geek show where we're talking about all the fandoms we love. Right now we're going through, which has been really fun, the Back to the Future films. You can also find me over there doing two other podcasts. One is called The Orb, and the other is Larry Treks. The Orb is about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and Larry Treks is the books and the comics of Star Trek. And then you can also find me here on this network doing Aggressive Negotiations, the Star Wars podcast with John Mills, as each and every week we talk about something in the Star Wars saga. But hey, thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.